This is the first of a two-part interview with Mark Speck and his research into the World Football League. The second part of the interview will be featured in episode 229.
It's go time.
Welcome everyone to Quick Kicks here on Third Down Gamble. I'm Don Charbon, and today we have a very special guest from the United States, Mark Speck, who is an expert on the World Football League. Mark, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. I'm very fascinated by the topic, but before we get that far into it, let's talk about you. Where did you start life? Where were you born? Where did your interest in writing and stuff like that begin?
Well, I'm from central Pennsylvania. Grew up there. Went to college in northern Pennsylvania. But I started really writing in high school. You know, nothing any major. You know, just kind of normal, you know, little short stories, that kind of thing. Did some more in Mansfield when I was at college. Again, short stories. But in about 1988, you know, I'd always been interested in football and sports in general and wanted to do some books on it. Didn't know how I had an inroad to it. But what I did was about 1988, 89, I was trying to decide whether to do a book on the WFL or the USFL because USFL had just folded. Trying to figure out, you know, where to get started. Who to call, what kind of publishing opportunities were out there. But I just started mostly this to research. And then probably about 6 years later, my ex-wife now got me a membership in PFRA. And that's how I met Todd Mayer, who had written a book about the WFL some years before. It was just kind of a real thin, small volume, basic information. But he was looking for someone who wanted to co-write a new encyclopedia with him, did that, and it was pretty well received, and it was through St. Johann Press, which is in New Jersey. Yeah, and it got some good reviews, was a pretty good book, I thought. We got a lot of more information, and then after that, then I was kind of sitting around and wondering, what if I could throw another idea their way, and that's what I did. It was a book about the Florida Blazers, the 1974 team that didn't get paid for the last 13 weeks of the season, came within a point of winning the championship. I thought it was always a great story, and I ran it by my publisher, who likes slice of life kind of books. You know, he goes, there's 200 books about the New York Yankees. I don't need another one. I want something that's unique, something that's like a part of a history that lasted a little while, but nobody really knows a lot about. So he was all for it. And since then, I wrote that book, wrote one about the whole entire league called Wiffle. Then I did a book about a minor league semi-pro team from the central Pennsylvania area, and then did another one on Detroit, the Detroit Wheels from the WFL. Then I am right now in progress with a book about the San Antonio Wings from 75, and I'm also doing an updated version of the encyclopedia, and I'm working on that. And meanwhile, I've been writing articles for the Coffin Corner about different things, some NFL, some WFL. Kept busy with that, but you know, it's just something that I've always been interested in, reading books as a young boy, just all different kinds of sports, you know. So I was just interested in that and was fascinated by these books that they had available that I just thought were just so interesting with these background stories. It wasn't just like, let's throw the Y zig out pass on third down and just that kind of thing. And I wanted more background. It's like the personalities, the different people that were involved. And it was really interesting. And that's what I've been trying to focus on. I throw some stats in the books. Of course, you're going to have to do that. That's part of research. And that's where you got started. I read the sporting news as a kid, pored over the box scores and the football scoring summaries and whatever it was, you know, hockey from the WHA and the NHL back in the day. So you have to have that. But to me, it's like really just the personalities, how people got along, how they didn't get along. It's been fascinating. It's been a great ride. Looking forward to these last two books coming out here, maybe within the next year. It's been great. And that's how basically I started. I live now in upstate New York. For a while there, about once a year, I would meet my publisher at a local function and get to talk to him. Great guy. and he's really supportive of my work, and he loves this kind of thing. Like I said, he's not, you know, I've got enough books about the Yankees, and I've got enough books about the New York Jets and the Pittsburgh Steelers. They're all out there. You know, what else can you write? You know, there's the entire history of those kind of teams. So I want something that's just like, nobody knows about this. This is unique. This is one of a kind, maybe. So it's been great. I love it and really enjoy it. It's a labor of love. I mean, I know you hear that saying a lot, but it really is. I mean, I'm fascinated by the things I still find. I was finding stuff today. You know, I'm still going through with the new encyclopedia, which the original I did with Todd was 394 pages. Just the chronology alone is like 400 pages. It's going to be, we're going to have to split it into two volumes. It's going to be like 1500 pages. So I went a little bit overboard on the research. You know, I mean, sometimes you just can't stop. I discovered newspapers.com. Oh, my goodness. That's just like opened the doors. You know, I could probably go back and rewrite the books I did simply by using newspapers that I didn't have at the time. It's just great. It's a great thing to do. And I love it. I enjoy it. And I'm looking forward to going on in my retirement. I've retired and just writing. Hopefully I get some more projects that he's interested in. Yeah, it's just great. It's awesome.
Now, you mentioned newspapers.com, which is a fantastic resource. But I'm also curious, too, the league now is 50 years past since its inception. In the 1970s, at least, I would imagine there's probably more archival material that you could access.
At the time, yeah, I probably could have. Like I said, in 88, when I really started doing it for, you know, for a serious endeavor, it was the old microfilm and microfiche with the big machine that you had the spools that you had to zip through and heard that noise. And that's really all I had. The local papers where I grew up, Central Pennsylvania, didn't really cover the WFL much at all because it was no team. They had a Philadelphia team, but we're far enough away from Philadelphia. It was all Pittsburgh. It was the Steelers. You had some Eagles, Penn State, that kind of thing. So you really didn't get a whole lot of that. The stuff that I'm going through is from the late 60s to the mid 80s now. It's just, it's amazing that you can get all this information on that website. And stuff when past the league, when lawsuits were finally ruled on and finally decided upon, you know, the players put a lawsuit out against a league or against an owner. So that's included in there. It's not just 74, 75. I went to training when I was working my last job as an investigator, and they taught us to slice the baloney. So you do the actual time period you're thinking about, but you go ahead in time, you go past in time, forward in time. And I've done that. That's really added a lot to it, a lot of texture, a lot of stuff that maybe wouldn't have gotten reported. Okay, because we really didn't do that much in the first encyclopedia. It was mostly just the league itself, some stats, rosters, that kind of thing. We did go a little bit ahead as far as what players signed in the NFL and the CFL after the league folded. But as far as like anything beyond that or before that, there really wasn't much. So, but I like to do that. I like to give people a background. I go all the way back to like 72, 73, because it was actually two WFLs that were trying to start up before the actual WFL started up. There was a guy, Lewis Roberts, from the Midwest, who was trying to start one up, and that was late 72, I think it was. Then there was another guy, Tony Rosano, who was going to start one up, and that was more like the mid-1973. Well, I guess Gary Davidson somehow got word that this guy was going to put this league out that was going to start in 74. He didn't want to get beaten to the punch. So he sent a couple of guys to one of their meetings, kind of got the inside on what was going on and, you know, got that information and then went ahead and, hey, we're starting the World Football League. These guys hadn't even announced yet. So they had to first change their name to the Universal Football League. Then because the WFL had such a foothold already, they really never got off the ground. But the funny thing was Davidson hired a guy to work for him as a consultant in the WFL office. So he must have recognized a kindred spirit with this Rosano guy and just said, you know, hey, yeah, you kind of my kind of guy. Let's come on in here and, you know, we'll work together on this new league. So that's how it happened. But yeah, that was actually the third WFL, which is part of my book, part of the trivia section of it. There's what, which I have found out the last like several years going through it, going through with newspapers, that kind of thing.
That's fascinating. I never knew about the other two. I'd always heard about the one that actually played. Now, Gary Davidson was no stranger to starting leagues, was he?
No, he wasn't. He was in the, on the ground floor of the ABA, the American Basketball Association, in 67. His role in that league has kind of been exaggerated a bit. He was in on the ground floor, kind of tried to make a move in. They really didn't know who he was. I guess he owned a piece of the Dallas franchise. And he was in some meeting and he was trying to kind of run the meeting. And George Mikan, who was the commissioner, the old basketball player for the Minneapolis Lakers, he had been named the commissioner. He kept going around, who's this guy? Why is this guy doing so much talking? Who is he? And we don't know. And they finally, Mikan took him out in the off out of the hallway and said, okay, you're gone. And then he come back in. Yeah, he's not here anymore. So, I mean, he started it out a little bit. Got some guys interested. He was very good at promotion, very good at selling, very good at that kind of thing. And then he went into the WHA, saw that was, he got after these leagues where players weren't getting a lot of money. So he knew that if he could get in there, maybe get the league started, raise salaries, you know, sign players to big salaries. He did that with in the WHA with Bobby Hall, Gordie Howe, that type of thing. And he was a little bit more involved in that, even though he went to a game with, I think it was Wild Bill Hunter from Calgary, I think. He was one of the, like, the hockey guys up there. And he didn't even know what was going on in the hockey game. Davidson had no idea. And then Hunter said, who is this guy? Why is he here? He doesn't even know hockey. And, you know, he didn't understand all the blue lines and the red line and, you know, this kind of thing and where it's going. And, but he was more involved in that. He got to be president of the league. He named himself president, I think. And I think that was the problem with him with the WFL was that he was more of a promoter and a salesman, not really much of an administrator. And that's what you really need at that commissioner level as an administrator. But he quit after the first year of the WHA because he wanted to get into the WFL. Quit as a president, went into WFL full bore. He said it was the best deal he ever did. He did have had some good ideas, but it was really a bad time as far as economics in the United States. The country is really in a bad, what's called stagflation. Instead of inflation, it was stagnant and it was inflation. So they called it stagflation. And, you know, they didn't have a lot of big money men. They weren't going to drop their money into something that was kind of risky. You know, they had a tough time to start with some of the, getting off the blocks. They had some good points too. So, but I think Davidson, like I said, if he'd have named somebody else commissioner, I think that would have really helped. Even if it was Chris Hemmeter, who wound up being the president the second year, just somebody who was an administrator or had some kind of a background in administration who could talk about business. Whereas, like I said, Davidson was more of kind of just a salesman promoter. He could recruit guys to join. He did that with the WFL, with the WHA, with the ABA, all three. He was able to recruit some of his friends, some of his buddies that he knew, some of the guys from the WHA and the ABA also went into WFL. So he had that inroad. So he was good at that. But, you know, as far as administrator, they probably should have probably put somebody else in that position with the league. I think that would have really helped him a lot.
Now, given these other WFLs, and I imagine that probably accelerated the schedule because I've heard rumors that he had hoped to start the league in 75. Is that true?
Yes. That was his main goal at first, was to start in 75 because it was already late. It was like November of 73 when they announced the league was going to be in existence. And that's, you're talking July of 74. That's like, you know, a baby can be born in 9 months, but you can't do a football league in 9 months. It's really, really pushing it. You're really asking for trouble if you do that. But because of that other league that came in, that was trying to come in, the other WFL, the second one, he moved up the timetable, really kind of hurt him. Wasn't a lot of vetting of owners or prospective owners. You had a lot of guys that had no idea what they were doing. So that really hurt. He had trouble getting venues for some of the teams because of the fact that, you were trying to do this in a hurry. You got into cities that had older venues, venues that were too small. I think that really hurt him, because if he'd have waited till 75, I think that would have really improved their chances of succeeding, because he might have been able to get some money guys in there, you know, some bigger money people, checked out the owners at first, you know, and give yourself a little bit more time to really get stuff built and not try to do it in several months. And I think that would have really helped him a lot. I agree with you. That's one of the things on my list. Just wait a year, see how things go. Yeah, that would have helped tremendously.
At the same time as the way the confluence of things happened, the CFL and the NFL were also in a bit of labor strife in 1974. Any sort of correlation there, would that have accelerated things? Because there were going to be maybe players that were looking for a job.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely part of him moving the timetable up, thinking that there was going to be a strike in the NFL. There was also one in the CFL. Be able to get some of these guys, kind of convince them to come into the league, sign up. I think that was definitely a big part of it too, because of the fact that, you know, it wasn't a given it was going to be a strike, but there was a good chance it was going to be. And he was gambling on that, I think, and was right about it. They did go on strike. That did help the WFL quite a bit. They kind of got most of the headlines that were positive, because the NFL's headlines were all guys sitting on strike, throwing rocks at buses that had players that were replacement players and that kind of thing. So it was really negative in the NFL. And the WFL kind of got a foothold. They signed some big name players to future contracts at this time. That really helped them a lot. That definitely was another thing that helped the WFL get its foothold and show that, well, hey, show the public and to some extent the NFL that they were serious. They were signing these players to big contracts. And hey, maybe these guys got money and this could be a threat. We better take them a little bit more seriously than we have.
And in some ways, they were almost unabashed about where they were going to set up their teams. Chicago was there, Philadelphia. They didn't care. They were just going to go head to head and say, this is what we've got.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, like you said, Philadelphia, Chicago, they had New York, Los Angeles, even though it was Anaheim, was Southern California. So you had a lot of teams that were in NFL cities. Houston was another one. So you had all these teams that they were putting in to cities that already had NFL teams that they were, you know, at the time, and Houston wasn't doing very well. The Oilers were terrible. They'd coming off 2-1-13 seasons. The one guy, I don't know if you remember or not, the guy flipped off the camera on Monday Night Football, right on the camera, the guy in the stands. Crowds were small. I don't know why they even thought that Houston would be a good fit, because they weren't supporting the Oilers. I mean, you can't blame them, really. They were terrible. But Chicago, that was a good choice. They had Soldier Field. They were to get Soldier Field, big venue. Detroit was a bad one. All they could get was Ypsilanti in Michigan, which was like 35, 40 miles from Detroit. Small venue for Eastern Michigan University. Philadelphia, they couldn't get the Vet. They couldn't get Franklin Field. They finally wound up in JFK, which was really not the best venue. It was really run down. The one story about that I heard recently was that Jack Pardee, the Florida Blazers, were playing in Philadelphia, and Pardee was giving his pregame speech. They were sitting there listening to him, and all of a sudden his player stood up, threw his helmet, just missed Pardee and smacked it against the wall. And they're all looking at him like, what are you doing? He goes, rat, rat. And it was this huge rat running across the locker room, you know, the lockers, and he threw his helmet at it, didn't think about it. You know, he might almost hit his head coach. You know, there were several teams that wound up dressing at the hotel instead of at the clubhouse there at JFK, because it was so bad. So it wasn't the best place. You know, they had the Vet right next to it, and Spectrum, I think they were all right there. They were trying, but I just think that Anaheim wasn't bad. You know, they did fairly well. They didn't have any, because the Rams were still in Los Angeles, so Anaheim didn't have a, you know, any kind of competition there for them. And then you had Memphis, Birmingham, Jacksonville, Orlando. So these were kind of new to pro football. Memphis didn't join until they had been ruled out of the NFL expansion when they picked Tampa Bay and Seattle. And then Memphis was really hoping for an NFL team. They kind of brushed aside the one guy that wound up in Houston, Steve Arnold. He wanted to go to Memphis. Well, they just weren't interested. We want the NFL. We've been hosting an NFL exhibition game for years. We want the NFL in here. We don't want some other league. So he had to move to Houston. But by the time Bassett, who was in John Bassett, who was in Toronto, he was getting kicked out of Canada, went to Memphis. And by that time, they had been overlooked by the NFL. So now they were all hepped up about getting a franchise, which they did. And they loved it. Birmingham loved their team. They had great attendance. Jacksonville wasn't too bad. Orlando was kind of iffy because the Tangerine Bowl didn't look like it was it does now. It wasn't this big palatial thing. It was just like, I'm thinking around 25,000 people. They struggled because of the small venues and that kind of thing. But, you know, they went into the backyard. They kind of rued the day that they did that. I think Chicago really was the only team in 74, at least, that really did well. They had good crowds. We're excited about the team. The Tribune carried them pretty well, gave them a lot of press. Philadelphia was kind of iffy. Houston was okay. It was hit or miss as far as the press that they got in these NFL cities. They were NFL cities, Eagles, Bears, the Oilers. You know, they were following them. They were covering those teams extensively, and they were just kind of wait-and-see attitude, I think, with the WFL and just kind of not really jumping into it and just waiting and see, you know, waiting and see attitude of how they were going to do.
You mentioned John Bassett and, of course, the Toronto Northmen. That actually came up in Canadian Parliament, that whole business of whether or not there would be a team in Toronto. And the federal government at the time introduced the Canadian Football Act in 1974. And it basically, in its essence, gave a monopoly to the CFL within the Canadian border.
Right. Yeah, I think the first reading it went through, it went passed by 118-90 as far as the votes. And Bassett, you know, he was from Toronto. His dad owned the Argonauts. He wanted to have a team in his hometown. He got permission to use Exhibition Stadium. The city council gave him permission to, you know, get a lease. He was really excited about it. He wasn't the only one that was up there. They had a group called Group 5 with three gentlemen who were trying to put a team in Calgary. They were going to call the team the Calgary Comanches. They were talking about signing Roger Staubach and some CFL top flight players. There was also a guy, Jim Pattison, who owned the Vancouver Blazers in the WHA, was looking to put a team in Vancouver for the WFL. So they got kind of antsy about it, thought that this might destroy the CFL, got kind of scared. You know, they had that legislation, the Football Act, that they put in there, like during the summer, I believe. Then, oddly enough, when they were talking about expansion teams in the WFL, they're talking about Montreal, they're talking about Toronto, you know, that kind of thing. In November of 74, there was talk about a merger between the two leagues, between the CFL and the WFL. In Parliament, Otto Jelinek, who was for them coming in, he had like a different way of controlling their coming into Canada. It was Mark Lalonde was looking for, let's just ban them completely. Jelinek thought he had a way of like, yeah, let's put them in here, but we'll put some boundaries on them, some limits to it. So that went back and forth for a while. And Jelinek was one of the guys that was for a merger, but it never went anywhere as far as merging in November of 74. I guess they just, the one guy said, I can't remember his name, another parliament guy said, the WFL was a sick, sick, sick league, and we don't need anything that sick. We don't need to associate with them. Most of the people in Canada were not for it. And I'm not sure how they would have done it. I mean, they did it in, 93, 95. They had the American experiment, they called it, with the CFL rules, NFL rules. What do you do? You know, they were just afraid in 74 that it was going to be the end of the CFL. The CFL was kind of struggling at that time. Financially, some teams were really financially struggling, and they saw that as they're going to come in, raid our players, take our fans away, that kind of thing. And I think they got scared. I don't know how it would have worked with a merger between the two leagues. The American experiment in the 90s really didn't do well, especially the American teams didn't draw very well at all the 3 years that they were in there. So I don't know if 20 years before that had done any better or not.
It's a great question. And it seems like every time there's an upstart league and they're struggling, a merger with the CFL is on the table. XFL tried to do it.
Yeah.
We don't know what the UFL is going to do.
Right. But yeah, I mean, even in 75, another point of that was Bassett was actually talking about moving his team back to Toronto and see if he could do that in 75. The two leagues had a real strained relationship. You know, the WFL was able to, you know, sign some players, future contracts, as well as 74 contracts. You know, guys like George Myra, Johnny Musso went to Birmingham, Rick Cassata, Louis Ross went to the Blazers, Mike Walker, Rocky Long, Sam Britz. So they signed some players. They had some teams, their cities went all the way through 75 thinking about they were going to be part of it. The guy from Portland, Robert Harris, he was the owner of the Portland Storm, said it. They even played a game in London, Ontario that didn't do very well. That game there between Detroit and Portland, moved the game there. I think they said it was like 5,100 people, but most people said it was near 2,000 to 2,500. So it didn't work out, but Harris was determined to put a team there called the London Lords. I think he was looking for 1976 to have an expansion team in the WFL, but he had applied to the CFL before the WFL and was really looking forward to that, trying to get a team there. But I guess the entry fee was a little bit too much in the CFL, where it was bigger in the WFL. So that's why I went to the WFL. It was an interesting time, like I said, Dave. What your thoughts are on it, but I just don't know if it had been successful. I don't know if it would have helped either league, but it was something they talked about, that's for sure.
It always seems to be out there. The WFL, for those who don't know, played in 74 and then partway through 75 and went belly up, basically. In that mix, there had to be some stories of players not getting paid. What all became of all of that in terms of some teams? Did they treat them well? Did they not?
Well, you know, some teams did well. There was two teams in 1974 that didn't miss a payroll. That was Memphis and Philadelphia. Because, of course, Bassett's team, first-class owner all the way. It's too bad they couldn't have cloned him about 9 or 10 times and had about 10 of him running the league, because it would have probably succeeded. And he was that good in the USFL, too. He didn't miss a payroll. Philadelphia didn't, because John Bosacco was pretty well healed. You know, they didn't draw very well, but he had a lot of money, so he's able to meet payroll. There was a lot of guys that missed a lot of paychecks, probably are still looking for money. And it was just about every team. Like I said, 10 out of the 12 didn't meet payroll in 74. 75 teams were getting, their salaries cut, asking them to take 25 to 40% cuts in their paychecks. The money wasn't there. The attendance wasn't there. The crowds weren't there. You know, Birmingham was doing okay. Memphis was doing all right. But for the most part, they just weren't drawing anybody. And it was really hurting. Some of the teams treated their players well. Again, you have to look at Bassett and Bosacco. A couple other owners were pretty good toward their players. Some of them just, hey, we can't pay you. Coaches would say, if you want to practice, practice. If you don't, I understand, because you're not getting paid. I can see that. So it was a crazy time there in 75. I'm not sure if they should even have tried it again. I know that they were hoping that was going to be a better fit in 75, but they didn't have any TV. They had TV in 74. It was, you know, TBS, which was an independent sports network. The networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, were all tied up with the NFL. So they weren't going to go with them. And then they didn't even get TBS in 75. So they wound up mostly with, you know, local TV, that kind of thing. They looked at a U sports network that was another independent network, but they were only going to carry like 10 games. They asked another network. They were only going to carry them on tape delay at like 11:30 at night. And even the WFL didn't want to have that. Without the TV, that exposure was not there. You had to rely on ticket sales, and they just weren't there. I mean, Philadelphia was terrible. Even though they moved to Franklin Field, which was a better venue than JFK, they, you know, you're talking four figures. The same with Portland. They were in the four figure range, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, that kind of thing. And it just didn't look good. It just like I said, to me, I don't know why they tried it. They did. I think they were hoping to get Joe Namath, but they didn't get him. You know, that's why TBS dropped out. It was a real hard sell. Eddie Einhorn, who was running it at the time, told Chris Hemmeter when he announced that they were going after Joe Namath that you just shot yourself in the foot, because if you don't get him, you're really stuck. You can't give him somebody else and promise him Joe Namath. And he didn't sign. I think it was mainly using it as a, you know, as a leverage to get a better deal from the Jets. And, you know, I think he finally just said, you know, it's too risky. I don't want to go to this league, and I'll stay with the Jets. He resigned. And, you know, I think if, you know, who knows if they'd have got him. They also went after Walter Payton, the Chicago team went after him. It would have been interesting to see Joe Namath and Walter Payton and John Gilliam all on the same team. That would have been an interesting fit just to see how it would have worked out, but it didn't. You know, it was another what if, coulda, woulda, shoulda, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it was something that they were hoping to get, but a lot of hopes and dreams, but they died on the field and on the ledger books, where it was, you know, red ink, a lot of what ifs. Talk a lot about that in the WFL project that I'm in on Facebook, you know, that we talk about the WFL, the history, and we've got a lot of the ex-players, ex-cheerleaders, some of the executives, and it's really an interesting group. But you talk about, you know, what ifs, you know, if the league would have made it and that kind of thing. But it just didn't. A lot of the teams, I think, tried to be as good as they could, even though they were losing money. But some of them just threw in the towel, I think, and said, you know, hey, if you want to go, go, you know, get yourself a better job, get yourself a paycheck, that kind of thing.
Justin Bell, who's been on our show before, talked about his time in the WFL, and he had some fascinating stories. And one of them was about Joe Namath. And some of the speculation was that if they signed Joe, maybe you couldn't sack him.
Right. Yeah, I heard that too. You know, hey, leave Joe alone. And are you going to get some guy like Dave Roller, who was really a tough guy on the defensive line for the Sun? And you're going to try to tell him not to, to sack somebody? I don't know. I mean, I can understand the thinking. You don't want him getting hurt. You're paying him a lot of money. He's going to put some fannies in the seats, as the old saying goes. And you don't want to see him get hurt. Just like this year with Aaron Rodgers getting hurt with the Jets in the very first game of the season. And they were all hoped up, you know, about that. It was all the hype, all the press and everything. And you'll never know what happened. And maybe he can come back from that. They say you can come back from an Achilles heel injury now. I mean, that was a death sentence back in the day, back in the 70s. Somebody had an Achilles injury. It was like, oh, okay, his career's done. Yeah, it would have been interesting to see, you know, with Payton and Namath and John Gilliam all on the same team, just to see what they could have done. And if they couldn't sack Joe, hey, they couldn't sack Joe. Let him play, you know, let him be out there. You know, I don't know how fair that is, but hey, you know, you want him in the game. He's your bread and butter, or he would have been. You know, it's just like you don't want to see like a Wayne Gretzky hurt, you know, that kind of thing. You don't want to see those guys hurt. You know, they're gone too. You know, it's going to be, it's a rough sport. But as far as football, if you're going to do that, are they going to be able to stop? Some guy comes steaming in from defensive tackle on a blitz or something. He's going to come running in. Is he going to be able to stop? I'm saying, oh, it's Joe. I can't sack him. Is he going to remember that in the heat of the moment? Or is this Pete Beathard, or is this somebody else who played for the Wings, you know, Mari Daigneau? Oh, nope, it's Joe. I got it. Oh, you know, is he going to be able to stop in time? You know, so, or is he going to hit him and say, oops, I meant to stop, but I really couldn't stop. I'm coming in too fast. That's the kind of thing you're looking at, is just that, is that going to happen? But, you know, it's interesting to think about. Again, another what if they would have been able to sign Joe, put him in there, see how he'd have done. I'm sure the team would have done better than, I think, the one game they had 3,000 people there or something, regular season game against Memphis. Couldn't have hurt, because the Fire did great in 74. They really drew some big crowds up in the 40, 50,000 range. I mean, even the off days were like 20, at least 20,000. And they only really needed 17,000, you know, to break even. Been interesting. Again, another what if.
They did attract some NFL talent to the league, and I think specifically of the trio that came from Miami Dolphins. Kick,
yeah,
I mean, Zonka,
yeah.
Warfield.
Yeah, yeah, they were the first ones, and it was Bassett again. He's the man. He could walk the walk, talk the talk. He didn't have any problem spending money. He had the money to do it. He had the guts to do it. You know, he was not going to be stopped. He talked to their agent and asked him about how much would Dean assign him. He wrote a number on it. He goes, wow, you know, I can afford that. So they talked to him and they signed and made a big, it was a big deal. It was huge. You know, I remember that it was in Time Magazine. It was in Newsweek, Sports Illustrated, the whole thing, you know, and had the floodgates opened. And once they started, and several days later, Birmingham signs Kenny Stabler. That's a big signing, especially since he went to Alabama. I mean, they gave a parade. They had like all kinds of festivities for the signing, you know, understandably. You know, they had a lot of guys that they signed. Rayfield Wright, Jethro Pugh, just a ton of players. They still don't know how many they actually signed, because the WFL would say, oh, we've signed this many and announced it, but there's all these other guys we signed, but we didn't announce it. You know, it's all, I've got about 75 on my list of guys that signed future contracts. It's somewhere around there. I don't know if it's any more than that or not. They tried to say that they had signed all these other ones. I never saw it. I've done a lot of research into it. I think it was just kind of like to just kind of put the NFL on alert, say, hey, we signed all these guys. Yeah, that was a big thing. And it called a future contract because of the fact they were playing out their options with their NFL team in 74, and they would join in 75 or 76 or 77, I think it was. Frenchie Fuqua was actually 77. And they tried to get Jim Plunkett. He wasn't available till 77. He didn't sign, but, you know, a lot of guys talked to him. A lot of guys, I'm sure, used it as leverage to get better deals from their NFL teams, understandably. And that's why the players were kind of disappointed when the WFL folded, because that was another avenue for them to use to get a better deal, work at a better deal. The players just had one avenue, and that was it. And that was to play in the NFL or go to the CFL or, you know, or maybe the semi-pros or whatever. But I think the WFL at the time was an attempt to get another league in and sign these guys. And they did. Like Craig Morton signed with Houston. So you had a lot of guys, a lot of players that signed future contracts and contracts that started in 74. And a lot of them wound up getting either cut or traded by their NFL teams, went ahead and joined the WFL early. Bob Davis was one of those with Florida. He had an agreement with the Saints that if they released him, he would be free of the contract. And that's what happened. He played for the Blazers in 74. A lot of guys got cut. I think they did it out of spite of a lot of the NFL teams. That's my own opinion. That's what you get for trying to go to some other league when you're with us and that kind of thing. Unfortunate. Some teams didn't do that. You know, the Raiders didn't get rid of Stabler. They didn't get rid of LaMonica whenever he signed. Now the Chiefs, they made a mistake. They got rid of Curly Culp, who signed with his son for a future contract. And he wound up trading him to the Oilers with a draft choice for John Matuszak, who I like. John Matuszak, decent player, not Curly Culp's caliber of Hall of Famer. The draft choice that they got from Kansas City turned out to be Robert Brazilli, who was another Hall of Famer. So they basically got two Hall of Famers, turned it Oiler franchise around, and the Chiefs kind of went in the, I think they were pretty bad then for quite a number of years after that. The Steelers, they had LC Greenwood sign. They didn't get rid of him. Stood pat and said, now we're just wait and see. We're not going to get rid of somebody and then lose them to somebody else. The future contracts. And with Birmingham especially, future contracts were good for the press and the newspapers, but bad for the bank accounts, especially Birmingham. They signed a bunch of guys. They wound up owing like $1.5 million in bonuses alone. They were running into financial difficulties. They were having trouble paying their players toward the end of the season, and they couldn't pay these signing bonuses. So the signing bonuses, they wound up being the reason that the contracts were breached, and the players went right back to the NFL. It was just a case of Bill Putnam was the owner there in Birmingham. He kind of went crazy with the salaries and with the future contracts. That just hurt them financially themselves. Instead of, you know, being able to have money to run the franchise, they had to pay out these signing bonuses, which were exorbitant for all these players they signed. Woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Thank you for listening to our show. Third Down Gamble is hosted on Podbean and can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Follow us on Twitter at Third Down Gamble. Join us again at the Third Down Gamble podcast. Audio worth watching.
Third Down Gamble uses the expert resources provided by Canadian Football League player and game statistics for analytics, game notes, and statistics, and 3downnation.com for news, insight, and in-depth analysis. Please visit cfl.ca and 3downnation.com for the most up-to-date information on the Canadian Football League.